Welcome to the Talking Poem Podcast. I'm Charlie Green, back from a summer hiatus. The show will be bi-weekly from here on out. Maybe I'll do an occasional short interlude episode. On each episode, I invite someone to bring in any poem they'd like to discuss. We'll talk about what excites us, what delights us, maybe what frustrates us, and we'll follow the poem and the conversation wherever they turn. On episodes like today's, the guest will also share a poem of their own before we move to some silliness and a game. I'm so excited to have on this week Nicole Cooley. She's the author of 7 collections of poetry, including her most recent, Mother, Water, Ash, which came out this year from LSU Press and is beautiful. She's a professor in the MFA program in creative writing and literary translation and the English department at Queens College, CUNY. She brought in Lucille Clifton's poem June 20, and she's a delight to talk with and listen to. So thanks for listening, and go on to the conversation. I was talking to somebody about this. They were asking if I can write during the semester, and it's not really. Are you able to write during the semester?
You know, for 15 years, I directed the MFA program that we started it. And so that was a lot because I was teaching 2-2 and I was directing it. And like CUNY has no infrastructure. You're basically a secretary, you know, doing everything for the program. So that was really hard. But I stepped away from that. And I have to admit, I just had a very luxurious sabbatical year.
Oh, nice.
And I spent the whole year working at the New York Public Library every day.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. So I live in New Jersey. But so that was really that was amazing and wonderful. And I worked really hard and it was great. But yes, for the past 15 years, it's been super hard. And I would try to devote one day to it. But it was just really hard, you know?
Yeah.
Really, it was really difficult. So I'm hoping that the sabbatical taught me a lesson somehow and I can be better going forward.
You know, I've gotten better at writing sort of catch as catch can whenever anything is there, you know, and 20 minutes never feels like enough, but, you know, doing writing in class with students and
exactly.
Yeah. Keeping very, very low expectations and stakes.
Yep. If there's one thing I'm good at, it's writing a bad poem. You know what I mean? Low expectations are I should have that on a t-shirt because I really my expectations are so low for writing and that's a huge help.
Yeah. I think everybody's an expert at writing a bad poem, even people who've never written poems.
Right. So. I know.
Well, let's turn to a good poem. You brought in June 20 by Lucille Clifton. It originally appeared in her 1992 collection, The Book of Light. I'll ask you to go ahead and read it and then we'll talk.
Perfect. Yeah, it came out in the 1992 book. And I think the book was just re-released by Copper Canyon recently with, I think, an afterword, maybe by her son, but I haven't actually read it. I love this poem so much and it scares me so much. I'm thrilled to talk about it. I'll read it. June 20th. I will be born in 1 week to a frowned forehead of a woman and a man whose fingers will itch to enter me. She will crochet a dress for me of silver, and he will carry me in it. They will do for each other all that they can, but it will not be enough. None of us know that we will not smile again for years, that she will not live long. In 1 week, I will emerge face first into their temporary joy.
Oh, thank you. I guess I'll start with a question. In a way, I feel like the answer may be obvious, but what scares you about this poem?
Oh my God, everything. So so the poems that I love most, and I've taught this poem a lot. I've taught it to high school students, college students, graduate students, older adults. I just bring it in everywhere I go because I love people's perspectives. What I love about this poem, what scares me about it is if you try to explain this poem to someone, they would be no, you can't write that poem. You can't write a poem that starts with, I will be born in 1 week. No. We're in workshop and we're no, Lucille, no, change the voice, right? So I think that's one thing. She's making a really fascinating point of view voice decision. So I really love that. It shocks me every time I read it. I will be born. I also think that just the details in the poem are so scary. And a lot of what I think actually makes the details scary is the sonic values, the sound in the poem. Crochet a dress of silver, right? He will carry me in it. His fingers will itch to enter me, that itch and crochet. It's so uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. It's so very uncomfortable at the end of those lines. And I find this, so I find the sounds really scary. And then I also find it fascinating that this poem, which is about, you know, is so tragic and about abuse and so scary, then ends with the word joy. Like mm-hmm. another thing, like if I'm always imagining like in workshop, right? Like if we're in workshop, I'd be like, Lucille, that's not your ending, right? So this idea of ending with the word joy, but having all of this complexity and terror in the poem, I love nothing more than a short poem that can truly contain multitudes. And mm-hmm. I feel like this poem really does that.
It is such a surprising poem, the I Will Be Born in 1 Week. That's such an unusual choice to set it 1 week before her birth and as if she's speaking into it. And you're absolutely right. The father character is terrified. And we only see him through action. It's the fingers will itch to enter me. He will carry me in it. If not for the first action, that might be something neutral. He will carry me in it. But because of that first action, it takes on this incredibly sinister tone. And then, yeah, into their temporary joy. And we end on the word joy. I think part of the reason it works is that it's mitigated or complicated by temporary. So
yeah, and absolutely. And again, sound, right? Temporary and joy, like those two Ys and the sonic echo of those two words. It's such an incredible ending to me. And to even, I mean, how about the penultimate line, like, in 1 week, I will emerge, you know, oh my gosh. The other thing I love is that's like always confusing and fascinating to me is the title, June 20th. So I read somewhere once that every year on her birthday, Lucille Clifton would write a poem for herself. I have no proof that this is a poem written on her birthday. But I also think like it could be the birthday is June 20th. It could be the birthday. This is June 20th and the birthday is June 27th. You know what I mean? There's this like weird complexity in this super simple title that just seems like a temporal marker, but like is still doing more work.
It's this weirdly resonant thing. By the way, I did fact check. She was born on the 27th. So technically we can say, you know, born on June 27th. This is a week before she's born. The temporality, part of what it does is just the defamiliarizing opening. Instead of being I was born, there's this immediate strangeness. And I was thinking about this with birthdays that, you know, even as I get older and I celebrate them a little less every year, there's this feeling of, oh yeah, I'm about to be born again, not in the religious sense, but there's this feeling of like a birthday can evoke every other birthday in a way, I guess.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. And you're so right about that opening because it's not, I was born, it's I will be born. And I also like when I'm teaching, I love to talk to students about how the smallest changes make the biggest difference. Like that verb tense, I will be versus I was, or I will be versus I am. Like the fact that it's conditional and future focused, right? Mm-hmm. I think it is so important.
Yeah, I think so too. And it is such a surprising choice. How do students react to it?
You know, it's really interesting. So first, I love bringing in a short poem to class because at first students are like, oh, this is going to be really easy. It's a short poem, especially undergrads, honestly. Like, you're not asking us to read that much. And then I'm like, all right, look at this poem, right? Because I, you know, it's the same reason I love bringing in Gwendolyn Brooks's We Real Cool, which also mm-hmm. is like a short poem that's like, yes, you might have read it in eighth grade, but it's incredibly complicated and fascinating. So at first people think it might be okay. And then when we take a deeper look at it, everyone is very upset by a man whose fingers will itch to enter me. It's also really interesting that it's not my father, right? It's a man. So everyone gets very upset about that. So we start to talk about in what points in the poem begins to deepen and progress, and you really begin to understand the emotional complexity, right? Because I'm looking at this poem and I'm like, how does she get to do this? This is so incredible. Well, part of how she does it is language, part of how she does it is sound. So we spend a lot of time on sound and we spend a lot of time on form, in fact, because then again, this poem looks like a fairly simple one stanza poem, but why is it in one stanza? I would ask students, like, what does that mean? You know what I mean? So it's a really great way, I think, despite it being a free verse poem, to get students to look really closely at the language and put it under the microscope, which is my all-time favorite thing about teaching.
It's so much fun to start in on a poem this short and then you look at your watch and like 25 minutes, half an hour later, you're still talking about it. I want to talk about the form because I have new favorite line breaks because of this poem. For listeners, a man whose fingers will itch to enter, there's that break after itch to enter me, you know, and there's which gives it that extra intensity. And then the same thing with "they will do for each other," which has that kind of like, well, yeah, they just kind of accepted, oh, you'll do all that they can, which makes it sound as if they are giving something to each other, and but it will not be enough. And so the as the sentence unfolds over those line breaks, the meaning just keeps changing and becoming fuller and fuller. And I just, it's one of the things that I really, really loved about this poem.
I know, line breaks are kind of everything. Like, I always think, and not to to trash prose, but in poetry, we get the line and the sentence. We get them both, and we get to put them in tension with one another, right? So, "I will be born in 1 week," break. "To a frowned forehead of a woman," break. So it's like, oh, first line ends with a W sound, second line ends with a W sound, then third line ends with itch, fourth line ends with crochet. So there's even something happening with line breaks and sound here, which is like amazing to me. And I also think there's a really interesting balance of image and statement in this poem, right? Being born to a frowned forehead is not being born to a mother. It's almost like Zeus sort of situation. And then there's that lovely alliteration with frowned forehead. But so there's all of these like super vivid, specific images front loading the poem. And then we get to the middle, you know, as you said, "they will do for each other all that they can, but it will not be enough. None of us know that we will not smile again for years." So I always think, like, what if she had started the poem with "none of us know that we will not smile again for years," right? It would be so much less interesting than the way she starts it. So she really like kind of earns the abstract statements by putting all of this super sharp language at the beginning.
It's image and action. And the sound of it is also fantastic too. "To a frowned forehead of a woman and a man whose fingers will itch to enter me, she will crochet." And there's just that movement of the F's, they're the, you know, the alliteration there, but also the movement of the vowels from fingers, itch, those I's to the E's. Yep. It's just, there is, it does build that intensity.
I love that. And like in my class, we also, we spend time talking about, like, with my students, crochet versus knit, right? Like, "she will knit a dress for me" sounds very different. Crochet, which is something you do with one needle, right? Which is maybe a one hand thing. Like, it's a different word than knit. It's a longer word. It chimes with itch. Like, and then we talk about, like, in my classes, why is the dress silver? It could be a dress of gold, but it's not, right? Is silver less valuable? Like, there's just all of these wonderful linguistic choices. I so wish I could talk to Lucille Clifton about this poem. All of these really wonderful choices that make the poem as rich and complicated as it is.
That is one of the things that I like about teaching a poem like this too, is it's very good for getting students to think about what they can pay attention to. Like you said, this poem could start, "none of us know that we will not." And I can imagine so many different sort of alternate universe versions. The past tense, "I was born," or "I emerged face first," which is more active, but not necessarily, you know, it's with the past tense, it doesn't have the pop and surprise of the future, of the future tense. And in thinking about that, what I was thinking about is the action, that the mother and the man do things, and the speaker doesn't really, like, the first time she actually does anything, it's emerge face first. And so otherwise, she is being, in a way, done to. She's being carried. You know, she's not knowing. And it's only that emerge face first. It's this really interesting sort of who has power in this
moment.
Yeah,
I love that. That's such an interesting way to read it, right? And it's almost like the speaker, the I is in the beginning of the poem, and then the I is in the end, and that kind of bookends the poem. But the middle of it really is about the family as a unit. You know, and this heartbreaking line, "none of us know that we will not smile again for years, that she will not live long," right? It's devastating.
It's a double whammy of retrospect. That it she's able to put us in the moment where, oh, everything looks positive. That temporary joy doesn't seem like it's going to be temporary before the birth. It's possibility, but she's also doing this retrospectively.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I think there's you know, you could teach this poem in connection with Sharon Old's poem. I think it's called "I Go Back to May 1937, in which the speaker imagines her parents, like, outside of the college gates. And imagining, like, they don't know, this is a horrible paraphrase, but they don't know what's going to happen. And so it's like, assignment, imagine a life, your family's life before you were born, but, like, you know it and you're thinking about it, right? Like, it just is a very fascinating spin on point of view and thinking about the speaker and what the speaker can do and where the speaker can be located.
There's an essay by a writer named Anne Panning, very short. It's called Remembering I Was Not There, where she's telling the story of her parents. I'll try to find either a link to it and put it in the show notes or a PDF, which I can send to you. And she's basically writing a scene of her parents before she was born. And you get the sense of there's the version of this she was told, and there's the version of it she's imagining. And I think what's interesting about a poem like this, what it speaks to in part, is as children, we often try to imagine what were our parents' lives like. And, you know, she's remembering her own childhood and at the same time trying to imagine that life before. She can only get 7 days prior to her birth. There's something very sad about the moment that she lands on.
That's a great point, actually, especially about like that's the moment she lands on, right? Yeah. There's so much to think about and talk about in this poem, right? It's just so, I guess the word I would use is it's complex and complicated, but it's also just really rich. And like you put give a little interpretive pressure on this poem and like so many things start happening. I think that's another reason I just love it so much.
There's a lot happens in this poem, just emotionally. It feels like, and it's hard to make a short poem do this. I mean, it's incredibly difficult for everybody, me especially, but it's hard to make a poem keep having a sort of bigger emotional push without feeling like it's being overdone or overblown. But we're learning more about each person. We're learning more about those interactions and how she sees those interactions. And it's just, has a real power that I love.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, like, I look at my own writing and so I'm a very messy writer. Like, I'll write like 30 pages to get to one page. And I don't sit and try to work on a poem like as a beautiful art object. I'm a mess. Like, it's the one area of my life in which I'm messy. Like, I'm willing to just write junk, write badly, fill a folder, whatever. But I feel like in so many ways, the writing that I admire most is the writing that I'm striving to do, which is so hard for me, which is this like crystalline, short kind of poetry, right? Where it's just like, there's so much here, but she doesn't need to have lines that take you all over the page. And she doesn't need to have a million parts. She doesn't need to take you up to her adulthood, right? She doesn't need to do any of those things. So like, there's so much left out here. And yet you feel like the poem is so fulfilling. I really love that about it too.
Yeah, it's so concise and crisp, the way the frowned forehead evokes the mother immediately. Yep. And notably, it's not mother, the frowned forehead of a woman, that we get a man and a woman, that they're even detached from mother, father roles and names. And then we just see him so crisply, the fingers will itch to enter me, he will carry it. We just see them so clearly and so immediately. And that's just so hard to do.
Isn't it? I know. It would be so different if it was like, I will be born in 1 week to my mother and my father. But the fact, you're right, that she doesn't ever use those markers. So there's this detachment, right? But also not. I think it's like, it's so fascinating. And, you know, the woman has a frowned forehead. The man has fingers. So they both have the F sound there. So they're connected through sound, but then not. I just find it utterly fascinating. I've read this poem so many times, and every time I return to it, I feel like I honestly see new things.
As we're talking about it, I'm seeing more and more. It's just kind of exploding. Like, even saying a woman and a man, it sort of suggests this distance that she feels from both of them. Like, there's a double meaning. On June 20, before she's born, in a very literal sense, to her, they are just man and woman. But looking back, that they are man and woman and not mother, father, suggests just the difficulty of that relationship. It's really powerful.
Isn't it? Right. I know. Again, like the small, you know, woman versus mother, like that small shift, I think, is fascinating to think about.
Other things you want to note about this poem before we turn to a poem of yours?
You know, I look at this poem and it reminds me of what I go to poetry for. Right. I think Lucille Clifton had a saying. She said, I want to write poetry that afflicts the comfortable and comforts the afflicted. And I've heard that attributed to other people, too. And I just love it. And I feel like this poem does both. Like, it certainly afflicts the comfortable. This is a very uncomfortable poem. Right. But on the other hand, you can also see a way in which this poem could comfort the afflicted. Right. So I love that kind of dual both and way of thinking about what a poem can do. And I feel like it's really contained in this poem.
I think there's a process note there too, that there are times when if I'm making myself uncomfortable in the writing, I know I'm on to something.
Right. Yeah.
Not always. And, you know, back to the, I write lots of bad poems, but often that's a sign that there's something here to mine and to articulate.
It's so interesting because one assignment I love to give in my undergrad poetry workshop and sometimes in the grad is for the last week of class, write the poem you've been avoiding all semester. Yeah. And everybody's like, what do you mean? I'm like, I'm not going to tell you anything except that I'll say, is there a subject matter you're avoiding? Is there a form you're avoiding? Like you're terrified of sonnets, you hate prose poems, right? Is there something that you feel you can never write about? And like, you're going to write this poem, you're going to only turn it into me. We can have a conversation about it if you want to, we don't have to. But it's like, what are you avoiding in your own work? You know, what are the things that make you so vastly uncomfortable that you can't write about them? And I think that's just interesting as something to think about.
I do something similar in my personal essay classes where at the toward the end of a class, I hand out note cards to everybody. And I tell them, I insist, they're not going to show this to anybody. I'm not going to take it up. This is for you. And you can opt out of doing it if it sounds too intense. And I ask them to, what is something that you would never write an essay about and why? And then once they've done that, I ask them to turn over the card and say, so why would you write this essay? And every semester, several of the students at the end, they say, you know, I doing that helped me understand why I wanted to write about it and how ways I could, which always feels rewarding. So
I love that. And then do they take the index card home?
I tell them they can do with it whatever they want.
Yeah.
So a number of them. It's a discomforting exercise. I always feel a little guilty about it because I'm asking them to think about something that's very difficult to think about. But I mean, it's a personal essay class, so we end up there a lot anyway.
Yeah.
But well, let's transition to your poem. And before we get to the poem, could you briefly describe the collection, Mother, Water, Ash? Because it really is sort of a unified collection.
Yes, here it is. It's very pretty, so I'm holding it up. It just came out. This is a book about my mother's sudden death in March 2018, and it's also about the disappearing coastline of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, where I grew up and where my mother lived. And part of it comes from a few sources. My mother died suddenly, and to make sense of it, I was just writing, and I was writing a lot of junk. Like, I wrote 50 pages of terrible prose. I wrote a grief syllabus. I wrote, like, just junk, right? Hardly any of it in here. I wrote junk, but it was a way to cope. Was all of this frantic writing. And then I was like, all right, what have I got? So that was one thing. The other thing is in 2005, August 29th, when Hurricane Katrina hit, my parents had made the decision not to evacuate the city, which was really awful. I wrote an entire book about it, my book Breach that came out in 2010, but they made a decision not to evacuate. My mother said to me on the phone in our last phone call before we lost phone contact, she said, we are not leaving, this is our home. And later she said to me, I will die in this house. And she didn't die during Hurricane Katrina. My parents were miraculously okay. But those words haunted me for basically 15. They've haunted me for all these years since then. And they've circled around in my head like, you know, we're not leaving. This is our home. I will die in this house. So then this all started kind of coalescing with my thinking about, ironically, a high school class I took as a senior in high school on Louisiana ecology. And it was an elective. And we learned horrifying facts, which are now like not even as horrifying, right? Like, Morgan City at the bottom of Louisiana is eroding at the rate of one football field a year. Now it's literally like a football field an hour. So we learned all this stuff and we took these field trips to barrier islands and waded around in hip boots. And I wrote poems as my final project, right? They let me get away with that. But I don't know what happened to those poems. But the stuff I learned stuck in my head. So when Katrina happened, I went back and did a deep dive into like the environmental disaster that is the Louisiana coast and read tons about it and caught myself up. And so that information really stayed with me. And after my mother died suddenly, I found myself walking on the levee. We live two blocks from the river constantly and staring out at the river and all of these things swirling in my head. And that's often like where poetry starts for me, is a bunch of swirling things. And I'm like, what is happening? How do they connect? What's going on? Yeah. So that was the process. And it all started. It started coming together as I thought about my mother and Louisiana. And then I was also mindful, I will say, not to make my mother's death a metaphor for the eroding coast and environmental crisis. Or environmental crisis, a metaphor for my mother. I didn't want those things to stand in for one another. That felt really wrong. But I also felt like they were deeply connected. And the process of writing the book was like trying to tease out those connections and kind of figure out why I was thinking about all of these things together, if that makes sense.
That makes a ton of sense. And the poems read that way. It never feels like one is a metaphor for the other, which I think is, in a way, feels like probably the obvious move to make, oh, this one kind of grief, another kind of grief. But you're not doing it in that way. It is more the connection between those things, which is part of why I love the title, that we have three very different kinds of elemental things: ash, water, and then the elemental relationship with the mother. And there are different things. So
I know. And, you know, I'm really, titles are really funny for me. Like, I often will think of a title for a book and it'll be terrible and I'll be wedded to it. And a million people have to tell me it's terrible. And in the case of this collection, I actually thought of the title and I was like, wow, that actually works. But, and I didn't, no one had to disabuse me of using this title, but this was the situation in which I was like, this, I just feel like this is the title of this project for whatever it's worth. Yeah. I mean, the mother, the water, the ash. And I also liked having it without punctuation. It just, I don't know, the kind of tripartite piece of it. And I don't know if you can see this, the cover here, but this is the work of a New Orleans artist, Sybil Peretti. I really wanted the work of a living New Orleans artist. And I really wanted the cover, I'll send you a copy of it later, an actual copy of the book. I really wanted the cover of the book not to be like a drowned landscape or a mother. I wanted it to have a more elliptical relationship to the subject matter. So her image is just beautiful.
That's great. I love that. So you're going to, and I'll ask you to read it, we'll talk about your poem Downriver, which is actually the last poem in the collection. So I'll ask you to, whenever you're ready, go ahead and read it, and I'll ask you some questions, and hopefully it will be relatively painless for you.
Perfect. Okay. Downriver. The storm is a girl on the edge of fury in a dress the color of lead. Not the girl I once was. Too easy. Let's talk about downriver parishes no one knows the names of. Not a spill of moonlight. No cool, loose dirt. Let's talk about a river. Thrashing, blinking open, no lovely blur but a wrecked yellow shotgun, splintered, crushed. Yes, I am talking about dynamite. Yes, downriver is a word. Take it apart. I am talking about the levee at Carnarvon. No metaphor. Only spill, only break, only explode, not edge. Yet how often I walked the Mississippi's shore, mud sunk, swirl of storm. No, too lovely. Tall river grass, levee stunned open, glow of a silvered moon between split trees, a body swept and dredged.
Oh, thank you. I love this poem. Behind the scenes, you suggested talking about this poem or another one, and this is a weird way into the poem, but the reason I chose it is that you're emphasizing the places that don't get talked about and that we have Carnarvon. And I'm just curious to hear a little about that. I did some looking up about Carnarvon, and the history of just the name is kind of strange, but.
Yeah. So what I was thinking of here, I was thinking about my Louisiana ecology class back in the 80s, but I was also thinking about a couple of other things. Like there's New Orleans, Orleans Parish and Jefferson Parish, and like parishes are like the boroughs, right? The other parishes surround it. But then there are all these other parishes that we never think about down by Grand Isle and Morgan City. And there's this sort of thing, expectation of like, well, those just get destroyed. So what are those parishes? And the other thing I was thinking about is when Katrina hit, there was a conversation right after Katrina, because, you know, Katrina was a completely not a natural disaster. It was a completely human-made thing. The levees breached because the levees were terrible and, you know, et cetera. So there was, when Katrina happened, there was immediately a conversation about how the levees were blown up on purpose. And there was a historical antecedent for that, which was the 1927, quote unquote, Great Flood, the Great Flood of 1927, which I was shocked to find out I never learned about in school, in which the southern parishes were blown up to ruin the black neighborhoods and keep the white citizens safe. So yes, when people were saying that during Katrina, yes, there was an actual historical precedent. Yes, that could happen again. So I found that really fascinating and interesting, and I wanted to write about it. And I was just thinking about like all of, you know, what does downriver mean? Like down the river, downriver we don't talk about. Like, and then I was thinking about other things like why are storms so often named after women? You know what I mean? Like all of this stuff. And what I really was thinking about after I drafted the poem, after it's like, you know, 700 horrible drafts that it started with that were 30 pages long, I was like, huh, I think in a way what this poem is about is ecological grief. And I also think this poem is touching on what I want this book to circle back on, which is this idea of let's not use the beautiful language to talk about disaster. Mm-hmm. Let's not say a quote unquote spill of moonlight or cool loose dirt. You know, let's not always make it beautiful, which is something that you still see in our contemporary language about disaster, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. A lot of stuff was spinning. A lot of stuff was spinning through my head in this poem, and I also made the decision in this poem to take out punctuation, which is something I never do. But I felt like I wanted the poem to have these blank spaces, omissions, and kind of junctures in between to make it, you know, at first it had punctuation in the first draft and it felt very static. And I wanted it to have more of a sense of movement. I was thinking about rivers. I was thinking about storms. And so I came to that as well. And it just seemed like it would. So I love nothing more than this is such a long answer to your question. I love nothing more than the arranging a collection. It's like the funnest thing ever. And thinking about what goes next to what. And I really liked the idea of ending this collection with the phrase, a body swept and dredged, as opposed to like ending it directly with my mother's body, but ending on a note of a body swept and dredged felt like that was the place.
It feels really resonant, both in the poem and on other poems or on the collection as a whole. I have so many things that I want to ask about it. The other reason I chose this poem is I love that what you said, that let's write or talk about the thing with literal language. Let's not let's not pretty it up. I don't know why I can't speak today. And that comes, you know, from something like naming Carnarvon to, you know, the different language in the poem that's about, let's stay within the realm of the literal. And it's still impossible to get away from it. You know, all language is metaphorical, but like Levy, stunned, open.
Yep.
It is carries, you know, the metaphor, but it's intense. There's nothing prettifying about it. I also want to ask about the spaces on the page, because you do, for listeners, there's no punctuation. Additionally, there are spaces within the lines. Sometimes it demonstrates sentence breaks. Other times it's sort of like breath pauses, I think. And I'm just curious how that happened, because you have the poem On the Levee, Once Again, I Walk to Sharpen, is similar in having those spaces. And I'm just curious how that came about. You mentioned it looking static with punctuation.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really funny. So my MFA is in fiction. And I published a novel 2 million years ago. But I do, and I raise this because I feel like this is kind of important for my own poetics. So like when I for many, many years writing poetry, I was like, must have a narrative, must tell a story, must be a giant poem, right? And it was super hard for me to get out of narrative, focus on the lyric moment, not be super literal, you know what I mean? And I was frustrated. I was deeply frustrated while I was getting my MFA in fiction and writing poems at the time and then writing my first book. I was like deeply frustrated about how to deal with narrative. But there was something about this project and writing about my mother and writing about my daughters and being a mother without a mother and writing about place that somehow allowed me to step away from narrative more easily. You know, where I felt less like I need to tell the story of everything that ever happened on this levee by my house. You know what I mean? I don't need to actually do that. And I was like, okay, what would happen if you gave yourself a little more sort of space? And if you gave yourself, I mean, these are questions I asked in revision, and you gave yourself space to leave things out. What would happen if you didn't jam everything into a poem? You know what I mean? Which is always what I want to do. And so I found that putting the spaces in allowed me to think differently about omission, negative space, blank space, and what is left out. And that felt useful to me, you know, because there's a whole other poem happening in the middle of those blank spaces. But yeah, I really wanted to play with that. I'm also really interested in this idea of, and this is going to be highly simplistic, but there's kind of like the poem as the mind in action and the poem as artifact. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm not privileging one over the other, but I feel like they're very different impulses. And I'm interested in that, like how that plays out. Like every poem has its own like reason for being and its strategy. And every poem doesn't fall into those categories. But I was interested in this poem in Downriver of playing with that idea of the mind in action, especially as a way to end as well. So the collection didn't feel like it just ended on a note of resolution or total despair, right? I didn't want it to foreclose anything. I wanted it to end on a kind of idea of openness.
I like that way of thinking about it a lot. One quick note just about Carnarvon, since I did the research. Yeah. Part of it, what I like that you name about it, because it's a place I'm completely unfamiliar with, it's an unincorporated community, and there are a lot of those in the U.S. and in that area. And yep. It's this sort of like you're detached from the narrative and you're sort of detached from the sort of basic things that come with being a city. Also, it's named after a plantation, which I didn't know. Apparently, a lot of places down there are named after plantations, but the plantation is believed to be named after a town in Wales, which is just very strange.
That is totally fascinating. I did not know that. Yes, there are a lot of plantations and a lot of things named after plantations. It's truly awful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, like place names. I mean, I'm fascinated by place in general. And I felt like, and again, like the places that we don't think about, the places that we haven't read about, the places that I didn't learn about in school, like what are those places, you know? Mm-hmm.
I remember so vividly during Hurricane Katrina, the narrative was almost both during and in the aftermath. It was New Orleans and sort of like the coast of Mississippi. Yep. Like, and there was very little sort of focus anywhere else or naming of other places. And you know, even in a tragic event, enormous, terrible event like that, so much gets lost.
I know. And I think about that a lot because we seem to have, to state the obvious, more and more terrible, tragic events all the time, like the fires, the floods. And I think about the way we talk about disaster and catastrophe on the news and the way we think about it individually and which people we remember and who we bear witness to. You know, it's just like it feels incredibly important to think about all that right now.
And part of it is just the difficulty of volume, that there are so many places and so many narratives. But the fact that the same kinds of omission happen so often with these kinds of narratives. On that note, are you ready to transition to the silliness?
I am. I have to tell you, I'm a little terrified of the silliness because listening to the podcast, your other guests have done so well, and I feel I may fail at the silliness, but here I am.
There's no failing at the silliness. As long as you're in the spirit, it's great.
All right.
Did you watch much of the Olympics?
I really did not.
Okay. Did you see, this is not relevant to anything, but did you see the pole vaulter who, by his genitals, failed to clear the bar?
Oh, no, that's terrible. Oh, no.
Oh, it's terrible and very funny. I hesitate to send the picture, but anyway. Well, this episode first, it's brought to you by a new anthology, Olympic Poems, a wide variety of poets contributed in honor of the now concluded Summer Olympic Games. It's sure to stir your patriotic heart because, as we all know, there are only two acceptable forms of patriotism in this country. They are rooting for Olympic athletes and hating the British. So there are poets in this anthology like Theodore Reth Karadi, Carl Lewis Carroll, and Allison Flo Joseph, and great poems like Robert Frost, Nothing Gold Can Stay Unless It Was Won by an Athlete from the USA, USA, USA. There's Adrian Rich's poem about practice, Diving Into the Rec Room, and Elizabeth Bishop's In the Weightlifting Room. So you'll love, I'm skipping a joke here because it doesn't work. Of course, lastly, you're going to love the centerpiece of the anthology, Emily Dickinson's This Is the Hour of Ledecky. That's a new anthology, Olympic Poems, available at pawn shops everywhere. So I'm going to stick with the Olympic theme for the quiz.
Okay.
So this is a little bit true. Did you know that poetry was actually a competitive event in the Olympics from 1912 to 1948?
No, really?
Yeah, it really was. The guy who basically is responsible for the modern Olympics is a French baron named Pierre de Coubertin. He believed that the modern games had to reflect sort of the classical games and, quote, I'm quoting here, reunite in the bonds of legitimate wedlock, a long divorced couple, muscle and mind. There's a lot to dig in there, but just the idea that there had to be both the intellectual strength and the strength of sport. So there were actually five arts categories.
Wow.
There was architecture, literature, music, painting, and sculpture. Which, I mean, they're not really competitive categories, but somehow they were. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions about literature competitions at the Olympics.
Okay.
Nicole Cooley, are you ready to play?
I am ready.
Okay. Five questions. Question number one, true or false? The first gold medal in literature at the Olympics was awarded to the man responsible for creating the games, Pierre de Coubertin. True or false?
Oh, I feel like that has to be true.
It is true. It was awarded to Georges Horrod and Martin Eschbach, but it turned out that he created those pseudonyms for himself.
Oh,
and
my
it
God.
Was only years later that this came to light. So you're one for one.
Classic and perfect. Yes. Yeah. Excellent.
So, true or false, the poems were required to be about classical subjects of ancient Greece.
Oh, I wonder if that would be true as well. True?
False. They were required to be about sport.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the first gold medal winner was a poem called Ode to Sport. over time, they became more and more specific about different kinds of sports, but... Okay, so you're one for two. Question three, this is also true or false. There were categories for both lyric poems and epic poems.
Oh, I really want that to be true, so I'm going to say true.
It is true. It did not start out that way, but what they found, the first year only five people submitted poems, but it very quickly ramped up, and so they found themselves having to distinguish between epic poems and lyric poems. And this leads into question four, which is our one and only multiple choice question. So they ended up creating a category for dramatic works. And at the 1932 Olympic Games in Los Angeles, one of the judges was a well-known American playwright. So was it A, Eugene O'Neill, B, Clifford Odets, or C, Thornton Wilder?
Oh my gosh. This is so tough. I knew who I wanted it to be. But I think I'm going to go for a different answer. Clifford Odets?
No. Who did you want it to be?
I wanted it to be Eugene O'Neill.
Oh, that's then it would be funny if it were Eugene O'Neill or interesting, but it was Thornton Wilder.
All right. Makes sense.
So, which in retrospect makes a certain amount of sense to me.
Yeah.
After the Olympic Games were over, he said, quote, "If we continue encouraging them, we may be able to build up a tradition that will call forth some splendid work."
Excellent. I love that.
Yeah. But it never reached that. There's some weird things. So the 36 Olympics in Berlin, the medalists were German and Italian in the the poetry. It's like, oh, well, yes, these are national. We're being nationalistic and fascistic. So last question, true or false? No American ever medaled in literature at the Olympic Games.
I really want that to be false.
I'm sorry, it's true. American ever medaled.
Wow. Wow.
So the closest in the 32 games, which were again in Los Angeles, someone named Avery Brundage was awarded an honorable mention. And technically he was third, but they did not give him a medal.
Oh, why?
Very strange. I don't know. What's weird about it is that there's some of this history is just gone. Like on the Olympics main webpage, they don't list any of these old awards because they were only from 1912 to 1948. And so it just seems to be largely erased from history. Like most of the poems are just gone, apparently.
Why did it end in 1948 then?
I think it was waning interest, basically.
Okay.
And part of it was, it's right after World War II. There were no games in 44. And in 48, that was the last year. And I think that the very first year in 1912, they had like five applicants. I think they only had like five or six in 48. And it just didn't seem like, it also seems like there are just so many problems with it, because English was not used as sort of the lingua franca. Like there were poems in German and in French and in Italian. And so are we working from translations? It's just seems complicated to me. So
you're so right. Oh, my gosh. I learned so much from this game. I had no idea about any of this.
I didn't either. I came across it. I came across it somewhere. There's an article in Lit Hub. There have been a couple of articles in the New York Times and it was Smithsonian Magazine because they ran it during the Olympic Games. That's where I saw it. Nicole, thank you so, so much for being here. Is there anything you would like to say or mention or plug before we go?
No, just that it was a real joy to be here with you and talk poetry. And I so appreciate your inviting me on. This was super fun.
No, thank you so much. I'm just realizing I forgot to write my closing. So let's see if I can remember it since I took the summer off from recording. Listeners, thank you so much for listening. Go have a great day. Read some poems, pet some dogs, and support striking workers wherever you find them. Bye. Hey, I remembered it. Woohoo!